Hi, this is Fred Zaspel, executive editor here at Books at a Glance. Today we are talking with three authors, Tony Shute, Nathan Finn, and Michael Haken, about their new book, The Baptist Story, From English Sect to Global Movement, a new textbook on Baptist history. We're glad for the book. We're glad for them to be with us. Welcome, you guys. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Hello. Yeah, pleasure.
All right.
Yep.
Three authors, one book. First off, whose idea was this, and how did this project get underway in the first place? How did you divvy up the responsibilities? How did this project work from beginning to end?
Well, I'll chime in on that. It's kind of like Baptist Beginnings themselves. We have two different beginnings to this Baptist story book. Michael and I met, I think, in an SBC conference and just were becoming acquaintances and talking about current projects we were working on. And in the process of that conversation, we both discovered we didn't have a Baptist textbook that we really enjoyed. We had several we were using and could use, but nothing that we actually thought fit our particular teaching style or perspective. And so we started a conversation there. And in that conversation, we mentioned Nathan being a possibility, a co-author. But I think, as Nathan can testify, he had also other plans in writing a Baptist textbook as well.
Yeah, I don't know that I originally had plans in writing a Baptist textbook, but separate from that conversation that Tony and Michael had, B&H Academic actually approached me and Michael, and originally a couple of other men as well, about having a four-authored textbook, and we couldn't get the two other men on the same page, and then Tony's name came into the mix, and so it ended up being a three-authored textbook, tri-authored textbook, and so it very much, there's a polygenetic origin to the textbook. It doesn't date back to AD 30 or 1525 or 1609, but I do think there's a sense in which it dates to 2008 and 2009 and 2011 before it finally evolved into what it is now.
Okay, and how'd you divvy up the responsibilities?
Well, I think that was.
Go ahead, Michael.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that was fairly easy in one sense. We all have areas of different specialty, so mine would be definitely 18th, and I could handle the 17th. And Tony's expertise was definitely focused on the 19th, and Nathan's was the 20th. So it was very easy in that sense.
Okay, that worked out well. Okay,
plus, we thought Nathan could write about the living better than he could write about the dead.
There's absolutely nothing dangerous or dicey about writing about the living. So I relish that opportunity.
So Michael and I punted.
Okay, all right. Tell us about the book in broad strokes. What can the reader expect? And here's some other things. What did you set out to accomplish? How is your book filling a niche, if any? What parameters have you set for yourself? Those kinds of things.
So I think one of the things that definitively sets this book apart from other similar books, and this was very intentional from the beginning, is that we wanted to write a true textbook. We did not want to write what is often the case with books in this genre, sort of a magnum opus that's written near the end of one person's career where they collate everything their doctoral students have ever done and claim it as their own with lots of footnotes. That was not our goal. What we did is sort of thought about the very best undergraduate history textbooks that we were familiar with, whether it's American history, Western civilization, English history, whatever the case might be, and we asked ourselves, what are the sorts of qualities in those textbooks? Well, they tend to be grand narrative type books. They tend to focus on major figures, themes, controversies, ideas. That they tend to be broader in scope rather than more narrow in scope, and they tend to have minimal footnotes, if any. And instead, they refer people to further reading, where that's more technical and scholarly, or they have information boxes that zero in on particular stories and figures. And we decided from the very beginning that was what we wanted to do for Baptist history. So whether it's an upper-level undergraduate student, or whether it's a first- or second-year seminary student, or whether it's a Baptist pastor who wants to be familiar with the Baptist story, we wanted to give that individual that sort of resource. And so our mantra from the very beginning has been, we're not writing this book primarily with scholars in mind. We're writing with students in mind. And we don't want the textbook that a student has in a Baptist history class to be a hindrance to him or her enjoying that class and learning more about what it means to be a Baptist in that class.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Could your book be applicable for use in a local church?
Absolutely.
Well, we like to think so. Not just saying that, but we did write, again, as Nathan said, we wrote for students in mind. And just because a person is not enrolled in a college class doesn't mean they're not a student of some sort. So, of course, we would love for Baptist churches and maybe even churches outside the Baptist tradition to consider it for small group study. Again, we're not writing it to show off our scholarly credentials or trying to communicate a story. And that word story was important to us all. We wanted to have a narrative, not just a list of facts and things for people to memorize, but to bring some, you know, flesh and blood to the story itself and talk about the very people who formed the Baptist movement, which were, you know, in large part local church members.
Yeah. Okay, you mentioned that there are basically three approaches to Baptist identity. So let's go with that for just a second. What is a Baptist, as you use the term in the book, and what's essential to being a Baptist? Is that title useful for some who don't necessarily have the label on their door?
Well, this isn't opening up a can of worms at all, is it? So we definitely see that different people sort of come into their Baptistness differently. And so some people have been raised as Baptists. I think we call that Baptist by conditioning. And then there are some who just sort of move around from church to church, and they land in a Baptist church, not because it's a Baptist church, but because they like the preacher or the music or the youth ministry or it's close to home or whatever. And they might be a Baptist by convenience, but they might be a Methodist if they move to a new town and they like the same thing there. And then there are Baptists by conviction. You know, their theological conviction puts them there. So we value those first two categories. But ideally, we want to see people be Baptist by conviction or whatever sort of Christian they are by conviction. And I think we would also recognize that especially in the last 100 to 125 years, in many ways directly related to the modern missions movement as well as just some of the general ambiance of American culture, there's been a great proliferation of what might be called Baptistic or Baptist-ish Christianity, where these aren't folks who would self-identify as Baptists. Frankly, even some convictional Baptists don't self-identify as Baptists. But when you look at their understanding of the Christian life, and especially how that plays out in the context of the local church, they quack like Baptists and walk like Baptists. And so we don't have to call them Baptists, but we recognize that they are theological and ecclesiological kindreds. And so in that way, Baptists are perhaps maybe a victim of their own success, that you know we've spread our identity abroad so much so that many people don't recognize it as Baptist identity anymore. It's just sort of low church evangelical identity in many ways.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Baptist origins. Your subtitle reads, From English Sect to Global Movement. Tell us about the English sect. How, when, where did Baptists come about as a distinct group historically?
You have probably a couple of origins that you need to recognize. One is the group that have come to be called the General Baptists. Theologically, as they develop a kind of modified Arminianism, they stem out of Puritanism. Both groups do. I think it's very critical to see the kind of the historical matrix out of which Baptists' origins lie is that of Puritanism. And the key name associated with that first group, the General Baptists, is John Smith. Originally would have been part of the kind of Puritan mainstream in the Church of England, seeking to reform the Church of England. in the first decade of the 17th century, comes to the convictions of the need for separation of church and state, that the idea of a state church has no foundation in Scripture, and because of persecution, he and his congregation that he had established in the in Lincolnshire moved to Holland, which was going through a kind of golden age of toleration. And it is there that he comes to Baptist convictions, that believers' baptism is the New Testament norm for entry into the church. The second group of Baptists, and he has an interesting career in one sense, Smith, just to finish with him, because he, within a year of his becoming, or a couple of years of becoming Baptist, he basically embraces a Mennonite position and disappears into a kind of a Mennonite group. And it's left up to one of his co-workers there, Thomas Helwys, to lead that congregation back to England and plant the first Baptist church on English soil around 1612, 1613. The second group is the particular Baptists, so-called because of their Calvinism and their commitment to particular redemption, or a limited atonement, as it's been sometimes called. And they emerge in the 1630s, again out of a Puritan context, and come to Baptistic convictions, and that both Congregationalism and Baptistic convictions by 1638, the first church being founded in London by a man named John Spilsbury.
And by 1644... They arise independently of the General Baptists?
Yes, although there is significant interplay between the General Baptists and the particular Baptists in those early years. There is a degree of fluidity, I think, that Baptist historians have not always recognized, and that partly because of a lack of knowledge of some of the primary sources. But yes, they come to those convictions independently, but once they have come to those convictions, there are links made and connections made. Although the particular Baptists do seek to eventually, by 1644, identify themselves as part of that kind of Calvinist international, to use a Marxist term. That is that body of Calvinist churches spread throughout Europe, and they're not. They know that they're not Arminian, or even, you know, that sort of theological position of the General Baptist is not theirs.
All right, Jason Dusing has written what I think is a very good review of your book for us here at Books at a Glance, and he offers a really strong endorsement, but he also suggests that you could have explored possible connections with the Anabaptists. What about that? Were there any connections historically, any observable links, any kind of influence from the Anabaptists? What place does Anabaptism have in the study of Baptist history?
Well, this is a contentious issue among Baptist historians regarding our origins. To what degree are the Anabaptists our roots rather than the Puritans? And nobody debates the Puritan origins. That's their writ in the factual evidence. It's very, very clear. The question is, to what degree are Baptists linked to the Anabaptists of the 16th century, who emerged in the wake of the Magisterial Reformation in Germany, Switzerland, Holland, and spread to other countries? The Anabaptists... Obviously, the challenge of the term is it's so broad. It encompasses a significant number of groups, ranging from Unitarians to revolutionaries who are like the people at Munster who took over the town and compelled everybody to be immersed as an adult, authorized polygamy, and eventually had to be put down with significant violence. And then to various pacifist groups like the Mennonites, led by Menno Simons and so on. To what degree are English Baptists linked to them? The one position that has historically been enunciated in the 20th century by people like E.A. Payne and Dr. Estep, who was at Southwestern for many years, is that our roots lie in the Anabaptists. and that connection therefore needs to be made very loud and clear. It was our contention, and we did treat the Anabaptists in the earliest chapter of the book because there are similarities. Those similarities, I think, are more because the Baptists and the Anabaptists are both reading the same scriptures. It's not because there are necessarily organic links of influence. There are links that are made. John Smith, after he had come to Baptist convictions, finds out that there are a group in Amsterdam who baptize believers, and they are the Mennonites, and he makes links with them. The particular Baptists in 1642-1643 rediscover immersion, and that through a Mennonite group in Holland. But these are connections that are made after the hard work of theological reflection and scriptural digging, the digging into the scriptures, has already been done. It would be our contention that there is no distinct organic influence. In other words, John Smith is not reading Mennonite authors prior to his coming to Baptist convictions. But it is a very contentious issue, and it's bound up not only with history, but it's also bound up with politics. I think what makes it to some degree contentious.
Let me also add, Fred, if I can.
Sure.
Part of what Michael is sharing is that we're trying to go to connectedness. Where do Baptists come from? And this is not to say we're not indebted to other people before the Baptist movement. Certainly we are. And we've also, again, writing for students, decided we can't give every reason for every position and go into great detail about our decisions. Our convictions are there on the pages. We believe what we wrote, but giving a long defense of why we decide this and why we decide that would have made this not student-friendly, but more for the professor. So
right.
A couple of other things going on there as well.
Okay, good. Good point. When was the first Baptist church in the U.S.? Tony, is that your domain?
No, that's mine. I just had done so much talking there. I just wondered if the others wanted to chime in. The First Baptist Church technically is the First Baptist Church of America in Providence, Rhode Island, who is linked with the very famous name of Roger Williams. Williams, when he comes over to New England on the way over in the 1630s, is reading scripture, as all of the Puritans obviously are, but comes to the convictions that the state has no role in enforcing theological orthodoxy. This gets him into trouble in New England, and he's ordered out of the colonies, but instead goes to what becomes Rhode Island. Plants what will become a new colony there, and within a year or two has been involved in the founding of a Baptist congregation. He's baptized as a believer, and there is a small nucleus of Baptists. But within a year, less than a year, he like John Smith, has also moved on. He becomes convinced that there is no proper administrator who can perform believers' baptism. One of the questions that is floating around the 17th century that rarely ever comes up today in many Baptist circles is not simply the mode of baptism or the subject of baptism, but who can baptize? And that's a very important question in the 17th century. And Smith becomes convinced that unless there is a restoration of the apostles, there is no valid baptism at all, and therefore there are
Smith?
No valid churches. Sorry, Williams.
Or?
Yeah,
Williams.
No, Williams.
Okay.
Forgive me. Yeah, Williams. And so Williams comes to this conviction that there are no valid, that unless there is a proper administrator, and only those administrators can be appointed by the apostles, and the office of apostle has to be restored, and therefore there are no valid baptisms, no valid churches. And he becomes a seeker. He becomes one who is waiting for the restoration of that office. In England, similar people believe that they find that restoration in the Quaker movement, in people like George Fox, who they believe are apostolic figures. Williams rejects that completely and has a number of attacks on the Quakers. So Williams spends his life after a brief interlude as a Baptist and founding this Baptist church as a seeker. In some ways, the first Baptist church is the one in Newport, Rhode Island, founded by John Clark. And
what year was that?
That would be about 1640. 1639, 1640, and that has a continuous history. It's the most important Baptist congregation there for a period of time. The one that Williams founds goes through numerous ups and downs, and really is not established well in many respects until the 18th century.
Hmm. You mentioned immersion. Baptists have always held to baptizing professing believers only, but has immersion always, with all of them, especially in the early years, been the practice?
No.
And if when did immersion win out then? And do I understand rightly that Clark baptized his entire congregation with one pail of water or something like that?
No, so, I'm not aware of the details regarding Clark's. You're talking about the one in Newport, Rhode Island, of Clark's baptism there of his congregation.
Sounds like a Presbyterian argument to me.
Yeah,
one pail of water for the whole congregation.
I heard it from a Baptist historian, though, so that's okay.
But pouring effusion was the first method. You know, John Smith baptizing himself, that was odd enough as it was. But also, immersion doesn't come into play until the particular Baptist define it as such.
Yeah, so it's probably around 1641 or 1642. It is entirely possible that that there was immersion here and there prior to that time. We know at least a couple of different individuals, John Merton and Edward Barber, had argued for immersion but had not taken that step. So the idea was in the air, but the importance here is the paper trail. And the earliest we can go on the paper trail is about 1641. And if it happened prior to that time, it was certainly anomalous. The standard practice, as near as we can tell, would have been pouring over the head.
Okay. The purview of your book is bigger than just the United States, but let's talk about that for a second. Baptists in early years of the United States had a big influence on religious liberty. Can you talk to us about that, maybe the likes of Isaac Backus or John Leland? Tony, is that you?
That's Michael again, but yeah.
Did you want to address that, Tony?
Go ahead, Michael.
Okay. Obviously, I mean, one of the things that comes into that's critical to Baptist thinking right from the very beginning is a congregationalism. And congregationalism obviously necessitates this separation of church and state. And the other two major models at the time of the Reformation and then into the Puritan era would be Episcopalian and Presbyterian. And both of them, really, in their classic forms, are deeply rooted in a kind of a church-state mindset or a Christendom mindset or the kind of the heritage from the Constantinian settlement way back in the early church. The earliest the earliest defense of religious liberty would be that of Thomas Helwys. So almost coincidental with the rise of Baptists and their first appearance, within two or three years, you have this defense of religious liberty. Thomas Helwys writing a tract, which he sends to the king, which probably leads to his imprisonment, the king being James I, in which he pleads for the recognition by the monarch that he does not have a purview or right to enforce religion over anybody, be they be they one of the various Protestant groups in Britain at the time, or be they Jew, Turk, or whatever, Turk being a kind of a code word for Muslim. And this becomes central to the whole Baptist tradition, this defense of religious liberty. And for Bacchus, Bacchus finds himself in the very difficult position of being in New England with men that he agrees with theologically in many areas. They're fellow Puritans, but who had embraced very oddly for their Congregationalism. And this was criticized by people like John Owen, the English Congregationalist. But they had embraced a kind of a church-state model in New England. And when Bacchus starts to write in the mid to late 18th century, there's already been a history of close to 100 years of persecution of Baptists in New England, going back to the whipping of people like Obadiah Holmes on the Boston Common in the 1650s. And the defense of Baptists, of their right to exist, and broadening that to argue that the state has no right to compel belief. But in doing so, people like Bacchus did not therefore believe that their religious views were simply to be held in private. They did believe in an interrelationship, and that the church and that Christians did have a role to play in the larger context of society. And I think that part is sometimes lost today. And so Bacchus saw this kind of sweet harmony, as he could describe it, between the church and the state, in which the church could have a beneficent influence upon society, but the state was restricted, as it were, in controlling belief, etc.
Is there an easy way to summarize the means and the process of growth of Baptists in the United States?
Summarize the means and say it again. Process.
The process of how Baptist grew.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to, if you're talking about the United States, it goes back to this idea of religious liberty. When you have churches basically realizing they have to stand on their own to gain converts and to get people. Of course, they want to do this anyway because of the commandment from the Lord. But there's no state support for the churches in the middle of the 19th century. And you have a situation in which if Baptists wish to grow or participate in cooperating together, then they're on their own. And so one of the great things about the Baptist story that we talk about is how the Baptist missionary movement takes place, in large part overcoming some theological obstacles, but also getting free of the political shackles that would have hindered them in the process. And so you do have a situation in which several things are coming together. Baptists are free to worship as they please in America. They're also energized to do evangelism. And they're also discovering in the 19th century cooperative efforts, forming local associations in addition to the work of the local churches, but also broadening out considerably into having state conventions, and then ultimately, in many cases, a nationalized organization like the Southern Baptist Convention.
All right. Back when you guys were writing this book, Michael, you wrote to me here in the Philadelphia area, asked if I could get a picture of Pennypack Baptist Church for your book, which is the first I'd heard of the church. And by the way, it was my son who got the picture for you, not me, so it was really easy. But it was the first I'd heard. It was the first I'd heard of the church, and it's fascinating 17th century pastor. Can you just tell us that story briefly?
This would be Elias Keach, I assume you're referring to.
Yes.
Elias Keach was the son of a very well-known Baptist in England, Benjamin Keach. Benjamin Keach, born 1640, died 1704, was probably the leading Baptist theologian in Baptist circles on both sides of the Atlantic in the last quarter of the 17th century. Voluminous writer, his work, he's got a book called Travels of True Godliness, which is an allegory cast in the kind of mode of Pilgrim's Progress. And its day was probably as big a seller as Pilgrim's Progress. Its lack of kind of substantial literary value meant that in the 18th century it kind of disappeared. Elias Keach was his son. Elias came to the States, came to the colonies, not the United States at that point, masquerading as a minister. He was not even converted. And what exactly was going through his mind, it's not clear, but he comes over pretending to be a minister and begins actually preaching and is in the course of his this kind of deception brought to his senses, is genuinely converted and spends about 10 years here in the Philadelphia area, the Pennsylvania area, planting a number of churches, really functioning more as an itinerant evangelist than a pastor, but was involved in pastoring the church you mentioned, and then eventually would go back to Britain before the close of the 17th century. So it's unusual.
Yeah, converted under his own preaching.
Yeah, that sort of thing would very, very unusual. And it's never been clear to me why he adopted this masquerade. But obviously he had grown up in the church. As such, had heard his father preach and was able to at least fool his hearers initially.
Interesting. Baptists and slavery, the good, the bad, the ugly. What do we have to look at in that regard?
Well, that goes back to before Baptist, the practice of slavery, and Baptists are part of this problem in American history and also throughout the world. In our case, in the 19th century specifically, it's highlighted by the formation of the Southern Baptist Convention. So you do have Baptists who own slaves prior to 1845. You have Baptists who are in favor of slavery, without even questioning it. And the idea of slavery being an evil becomes more and more prominent in the 19th century, and Baptists respond to that in different ways. Some who see the light early and recognize that it's wrong to own another person and that biblical injunctions about slavery are not the same thing as American slavery. And there are other Baptists who don't see the light quite so early, and they become defenders of the practice. And also, it's highlighted because of the role of the Triennial Convention, which refuses to send out slave-owning Baptists as missionaries. So we have a brutal history there in terms of my own denomination, Southern Baptist, our beginnings there, because it was founded on the basis of permitting slave owners to be missionaries, but also in that process defending the right of persons to own slaves.
Nathan, we haven't heard much from you today.
We keep talking about all the stuff that they wrote about.
Okay, let's talk about 20th century Baptists. I think most of us don't think in terms of anything significant in recent history, but tell us about the 20th century. What's significant for Baptists in the most recent century?
So Baptists grow at a really high rate from about the time after the Civil War through about the 1980s. So there's just significant growth among Baptists in America. It's around 1962 or 1963 that Southern Baptists in particular pass what becomes the United Methodist Church as the largest Protestant denomination in America, at least whenever you count all the dead people that were on the rolls as well. And that's not counting all the other types of Baptists who are out there.
Yeah.
So there's just a tremendous amount of growth, and some of that happens because by that time, Baptists, Southern Baptists in particular, independent Baptists as well, just kind of have an emphasis on personal evangelism in their DNA. So there's all kinds of, at the time, innovative programs to try and reach new people, enlist new members, assimilate them into the churches. And so there's a lot of good with that. But then there's also some things that maybe they're not bad, but let's say they're not as purely good as sharing the gospel. An increasing emphasis on pragmatism, often influenced by modern business trends, kind of making their way into the church. You also have a growth of sort of a revivalistic outlook. In many ways, Baptist worship services and Southern Baptist and Independent Baptist and some Free Will Baptist circles become attempts to kind of bottle up the revival experience in a 60 or 75-minute spot of time every single Sunday. And not all of that is bad. Some of it's a little weird. And so there's all kinds of different factors that contribute to Baptist growth. And then really as we begin to move into a post-denominational age, whenever many of the Baptist groups, again, perhaps especially the SBC, become characterized by controversy over theology and politics and personalities, you begin to see the beginnings of plateau and then decline among at least the larger Baptist groups by the 1980s. But really, for much of the 20th century in America, it's a fascinating and in many ways fantastic success story of growth. And again, I think there's a lot of reasons for that.
Well, my background is Independent Baptist, Fundamentalist Baptist, and so I grew up hearing lots about our history and the breaking away from the American Baptists and so on, and the fundamentalist controversy of the early part of the century. But what's fascinating to me is that despite the fact that they broke away so often, still the Baptists grew at such a phenomenal rate.
Yeah, I actually used to joke with students in my Baptist history classes at Southeastern Seminary that there's this peculiar thing called Baptist math, and it doesn't work anywhere else in the world that I know of, but inexplicably, Baptists multiply through division. And so, now my Presbyterian friend Sean Lucas assures me that there is a Presbyterian version of this as well. But
Nathan, am I correct in saying that was a saying in Baptist life for years, wasn't it? For our Sunday schools, you have to divide to multiply.
Heard that before, but I can affirm it.
Yeah, that was actually a slogan.
Well, that
not bad math, but a slogan based on bad math.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. So the interesting thing about Baptist is because of the emphasis on individual liberty of conscience, because of the emphasis on local church autonomy and congregational rule, I mean, that allows for a wide diversity of opinions, especially in the 20th century. I mean, some of the most fundamentalist and most liberal religious leaders in the 20th century were Baptists. And so you have that sort of diversity, and I think because of that diversity, it really shouldn't surprise us that there is this tendency towards disagreement and division and growth at times because of those things. It's just one of the oddities of being the type of group that Baptists are in the type of setting like America.
Well, this is fascinating. I could talk to you guys all day. I love your subject and I love your new book. And I hope many will pick it up and read it. It's a great read. Thank you guys for being with us. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fred.
All right.